You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
Mr. Presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right. Good morning, everyone. We're on the record on case CR 22-21-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. We're continuing with evidence on the state's case in chief. We had a witness that concluded at the end of the week last week, and the state's going to be calling a new witness this morning. I'll note that the jurors have all returned today, all 18, including the alternates, whoever those will be. And everyone has also completed their juror affirmation, so we don't have any issues there. I'll note the defendants present along with counsel for the defendant, Mr. Pryor. The state's also present with the four prosecutors handling this. Is the state ready to proceed at this time this morning, Mr. Wood?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the defense ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. And as it relates to the state's request this morning on cameras, the court's taking care of that. So, Mr. Wood, your witness will be able to come in and be sworn here shortly. We'll have the jurors brought back in if the parties are ready to proceed. Any questions about that?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Bailiff, please, let's have the jurors brought in then.
All right, please. Please offer the counter for Your Honor.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, thank you for returning. We are on case CR 22-21-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. After the weekend recess, the court's confirmed the jurors are all back properly seated, and I've reviewed the juror affirmations signed by each of the jurors, confirming they followed the court's instruction relating to not investigating or discussing the case with everyone over the break. So thank you again for continuing to follow that admonishment as you have done so each day. The state's continuing with its case in chief. We concluded with a witness at the end of court last Friday, and we're ready to proceed, I think, with the calling of the next witness. So, Mr. Wood, if the state would like to call its next witness, you can do that.
Thank you. The state calls Nick Balance.
All right. Thank you. All right. Before we commence, Mr. Wood, first I want to confirm our cameras. Okay. I believe it's Agent Balance. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Correct.
All right. Agent Balance, there's an exclusionary order in this case, so I'm just going to inquire before you start with testimony whether or not you have watched or viewed any of the trial testimony since it's been live streamed as well as open to the public here in court. Have you seen or observed in any way any of the trial testimony before testifying today?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
Okay. And have you discussed with anyone else their testimony they've provided in trial?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Wood, then you can go ahead and inquire on direct.
Thank you, Your Honor. And before I inquire, there are several exhibits in this case that have been stipulated to. Mr. Balance will be testifying to a lot of telephone and cellular data. And for purposes of keeping the record clean about what's in evidence, I do have 11 business record affidavits. I believe they all come in by way of stipulation. I don't know how the court wants me to. I can read off the exhibit number and the company to which it pertains, however the court would like me to do that.
Okay.
But I would like to have them on the record.
I agree. They need to be individually entered into or admitted on the record. So if you'd like to just go through each, and I'll inquire on the defense whether or not they agree that there's a stipulation and no objection. So if you would want to just go through those, I know that might take a moment here, but we need to do that to keep the record clear. So you can just start off with whichever one you want to get move for admission of first.
All right. And I would note that I gave a courtesy copy to the court and counsel last week of each of these. Okay. So State's Exhibit 125 is a business record affidavit for T-Mobile Metro.
All right. Mr. Pryor, on Exhibit 125, will the defense have any objection to its admission?
It's a stipulated exhibit, Judge.
All right. So that's a no. 125 is admitted, Mr. Wood.
Okay. States Exhibit 126 is a Verizon business records affidavit.
All right. Any objection on 126?
Again, Judge, it's a stipulated exhibit.
All right. 126 is admitted on one. What's your next one, Mr. Wood?
127, another Verizon business records affidavit.
All right. Is that admitted by stipulation, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Your Honor.
127 is admitted.
128, another Verizon business records affidavit.
All right. Will that be admitted by stipulation, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Your Honor.
128 is admitted.
States Exhibit 129, Verizon business records affidavit.
Is 129 admitted by stipulation?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. 129 is admitted.
130, Verizon business records affidavit.
Is 130 admitted by stipulation, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Judge.
Thank you. Mr. Wood?
131, Verizon business records affidavit.
Is 131 admitted by stipulation?
Yes, Judge.
All right, 131 is admitted.
132, Verizon business records affidavit.
Is 132 admitted by stipulation, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Judge.
132 is admitted.
133, Verizon business records affidavit.
Is 133 also admitted by stipulation, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Judge.
All right, 133 is admitted.
134, Verizon business record affidavit.
Is 134 also part of your stipulation, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Judge.
All right, 134 is admitted.
And the last one, 135, is an AT&T business records affidavit.
All right, is Exhibit 135 admitted by stipulation, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Each of those exhibits, then, the court concludes have been reviewed by the defense without objection. They're all admitted and part of the record. You can proceed then, Mr. Wood.
Thank you.
You're doing digital.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Can you state your name for the record and spell it?
Yes, it's Nicholas Balance. Last name is spelled B-A-L-L-A-N-C-E.
Thank you. And Mr. Balance, how are you employed?
I'm a supervisory special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
So is your proper title Agent Balance?
That's fine.
Okay. Agent, how long have you worked as a special agent with the FBI?
Since June of 2016.
And where are you currently assigned?
So currently I'm assigned to the FBI's International Operation Division out of Washington, D.C.
Prior to being a special agent with the FBI, were you previously employed in law enforcement?
I was. I served as a deputy U.S. Marshal for 9 years prior to being with the FBI.
And in your role in the FBI now, are you a member of a specialized unit within the FBI?
I am. I'm a member of our Cellular Analysis Survey Team, or CAST for short.
What kind of work does CAST do?
In the simplest terms, CAST is a group of about 70 to 80 special agents and task force officers that specialize in utilizing cell records from a provider to determine the general location of a phone at a specific date and time that might be of interest to an investigation.
And have you used those techniques successfully in the past?
Yes, I've used those techniques on hundreds of occasions to locate violent fugitives, to locate missing kids, missing persons, and really just a gamut of different investigations that the FBI conducts.
How long have you been a member of CAST?
Since October of 2019.
And how long have you been using cellular records in investigations?
So I've been using cellular records as a part of my investigations, both with the FBI and with the Marshal Service, since 2007.
Do you assist other agencies with this type of cellular analysis?
I do. I regularly provide assistance to agencies, local, federal, and state throughout the country.
How do those investigators usually come to contact you?
So usually as a part of CAST, we also do a lot of training and presentations. So I could be contacted directly by someone that participated in one of those trainings, or law enforcement can reach out directly to our unit, and then cases could be assigned to me that way as well.
I believe you might have already said this, but just in case, how many members does CAST have nationwide?
It fluctuates, but approximately 70 to 80.
How does one get selected to be on CAST?
So there's an application process that you would put in to be a member of the unit, and then there are multiple trainings that span approximately 240 hours before you'd be certified. And those are in the form of multiple training iterations that start with our CAST Basic, which is a 2 to 3 day training in which you would learn kind of from the foundation of what we do and not using any type of software to assist you. Taking cellular records, and like I talked about earlier, putting those onto a map based on a specific date and time that may be of interest to an investigation. If you complete CAS Basic and you're invited to attend the next training, you would go to our CAS Advanced. That's a one-week training where it gets a little bit more into the specifics for each provider that are the major providers throughout the United States, what their records look like, any nuances that might be a part of their records. And then also that's where we start implementing practical scenarios to where we're given a problem in the class and we have to do a report based on whatever that problem is, and then it's evaluated by instructors. Upon completion of CAS Advanced, you would go to, at the time I went, what was called our field training exercise, which is where you have approximately 3 days where you're given multiple problems, you don't get any support from instructors, and you have to solve those problems within a specific time and then present your findings on those. Upon completion of that, we have an additional 4 weeks where you would go to our what we call Certification 1 and Certification 2. As a part of that training, we have instruction from professors in the field of radio frequency. We have presentations from all the major providers, not only by their legal compliance representatives, but also by their engineers who set up the networks. They provide kind of an overview of how each specific network is set up. We went to see a network switch to see the actual physical infrastructure associated with cellular technology. And then upon completion of that, we're given a written test that we have to pass. And then the last 2 weeks, we do instruction on what's called drive testing, which is taking measurements of what the true cellular environment looks like for a particular area. And then we have a problem that we have to solve again that we take all the way to a mock court scenario that we have to present. Upon completion of all of that, instructors meet, discuss each candidate, and then if you pass, you would be considered a certified member of CAST.
And are you a certified member of CAST?
Yes.
So you completed all that training you just discussed?
Yes, sir.
So, and you completed it successfully?
Yes, sir.
I want to talk to you a little bit about cell towers for a minute. What, based on your knowledge and your training of cellular networks, can you explain to the jury what a cell tower does?
Sure. So a cell tower is constantly emitting radio frequency for a given area. And so if you think about it from the standpoint of whenever you're going to make a call on your phone, the important part is you want to be able to talk to somebody that's a great distance away. So phones work very similar to what a portable radio that you could go buy at an electronics store would work, works in the same way. So if you take that portable radio, you can communicate to somebody, but you're limited on the distance that you could communicate with them. So if our cell phone was only able to communicate down the street, it wouldn't necessarily be relevant for our day-to-day life. So what a cell tower does is it allows the cell tower to the cellular phone, instead of communicating directly with another phone, to communicate with that tower. Once it does that, that signal can be transmitted down the street or throughout the world to allow you to make a phone call to anywhere that a cellular phone has service.
What is the range of a cell tower?
So the range of a cell tower primarily depends on the area. So whenever network engineers are creating the network, they're ultimately doing it to support population or users of their network. So in an area like Boise, where there's a pretty high population, you'll see a lot of cell phone towers. And those towers are generally going to provide service out to the next closest tower. So like I said, in Boise, where you have a large population to support, the footprint of what that cellular tower is going to provide coverage to is smaller. When you start talking about Rexburg, which is a more rural area, there's less towers. So those towers are going to go out farther distances just because of the fact that the population is less dense there.
So is it fair to say that cell towers are responsible for providing coverage to a particular area?
Yes. Networks are designed to provide coverage to its users.
And can you explain what a sector of a tower is?
Yes. So a traditional cell phone tower, if you're looking at it from the top and think of it as that radio frequency is going out in all directions, almost as a circle. So to optimize their network, that tower is divided into three different sectors. So again, if you think about that circle and cutting it into a pie of three equal pieces, that's what a sector represents. So there's antennas on that tower that basically provide coverage to 120 degrees away from that tower. So if you think about that circle being 360 degrees, divide that by three, that gives you the three equal sectors that cover approximately 120 degrees up that circle.
And can you briefly summarize for the jury how a cell phone engages with a cell tower?
Yes. So your cell phone, even in your pocket when you're not talking on it, is constantly scanning the environment to look for which tower and sector are providing the strongest signal. So that way, if you do need to make a call or receive a text message, your phone is already aware of what tower and sector it's going to utilize for that interaction.
Okay. And how does a phone determine, or how is it determined, what tower a cell phone connects with?
So the phone is making that decision. And that's probably the most important part to remember that. The phone, whenever it's scanning and it's looking at the cellular environment that it's in, it's keeping a list of what that strongest tower is at any given time. So the cell phone selects the strongest tower and sector to begin an interaction with the network for whatever it is, be a voice call, email, whatever that might be.
And will that strongest tower always be the closest tower?
It can be, but also there could be obstructions in the way that it might choose a cellular tower that's a little bit farther away. So it's going to choose the strongest signal, not necessarily the closest.
Do cellular companies record the activity of each of their customers?
They do. So if you think about, you know, maybe 15 years ago, whenever you got a cell phone bill, and not only did it include the amount that you owed the provider, you also had a list of all the different calls that were made on that specific account. So whenever you're looking at the recordings of what a cellular provider keeps on the specific account, that's what we're talking about. So that could be the date and time, the duration of a specific event, the direction, whether you received an inbound or outbound call, and that's on your call detail record. The difference with the records that what law enforcement look at is it also includes columns for location information. So what that includes is the tower and sector that was utilized for a specific interaction that you had with the provider.
And I think you used the phrase call detail records.
Yes.
Is that the phrase usually associated with the records that the cellular companies keep?
It is, yes.
What pieces of, you kind of went over this, but what pieces of information are typically found in a call detail record?
So typically, just like on the old phone bill, you'll see a date and a time. You'll see what type of transaction, whether it was a voice or a text message. You'll see the duration if it was a voice call. You'll see the number that was called or the number that called into the account. And then, like I mentioned, with the call detail records we're looking at, we'll also see columns that give us location information.
Does the information captured on call detail records vary by provider?
It does. Most providers are going to capture the majority of the same information. They just might capture it different ways. But specific to, there are nuances specific to Verizon. Verizon doesn't capture the location information associated with a text message.
And other companies do.
Correct.
Do cellular providers maintain lists of where their towers are located?
They do. So each cellular provider has, by latitude and longitude location, every single tower that they have throughout the territory that they cover.
How do you use those types of records to determine where a phone was located?
So if you think about the specific geographical area, let's just talk about Idaho. So if you look at a cellular provider's tower records for Idaho, I can take those records and place them on a map for the significant area that we're looking at. So again, let's just say for the state of Idaho. With that, I can then take the call detail records and marry each line in a call detail record up with the location of the tower and sector that was used for that specific event. So if you think about it from the standpoint of every tower, if you imagine it was a mailbox on a map, I'm taking each line as a letter and delivering it to that specific mailbox on the map. So what that enables me to do is anytime there's an interaction on those call detail records, I can see at that date and time what tower and sector was utilized.
And how do you estimate the coverage area of a sector?
So that goes back to, again, talking about the looking at the population density is usually a good estimate, because whenever you see an area like Boise, the coverage area of a tower and sector is usually going to go out to the next tower and sector because they want to provide overlapping coverage to their customers. Again, I'll use a few analogies when I explain this, but if you think about in your yard, if you have a sprinkler system and a sprinkler head's only going out a couple feet, and then there's nothing hitting the grass for another 10 feet to your next sprinkler, you're going to have dead grass, just like you're going to have dead areas in cell service. Because of that, engineers, in order to optimize their network, provide overlapping coverage. So each tower is going to have overlapping coverage with the tower next to it.
Is there a way to determine the actual coverage area of a sector versus how you just described?
Yes. So we can do what's called a drive test, which is, I briefly mentioned, as a part of our certification process. And what this is we take equipment that has sensors and antennas, and we can place it. It's a portable unit that we can place into a car. And then we, in essence, like the name says, drive an area. And as we're driving, it's taking hundreds of measurements a minute of the location of where the drive test equipment is and what the cellular signal that it sees at any given time. So if you go to a specific area and drive basically every road, every area that you can get to, then what we can do is we can take all of that data, put it onto a map, and see what the true coverage of a tower and sector is versus what these estimates that I mentioned are.
And is drive testing used in the cellular industry?
Yes, drive testing would be the industry standard for determining the true coverage of a cellular footprint.
Did you conduct a drive test in this case?
I did.
What was the area that you conducted your drive test over?
So we conducted the drive test pretty much throughout Rexburg, all the way up to the area around St. Anthony and down just a little bit south of Rexburg.
When did you do that?
We did that in June of 2020.
Was there an event that led to you performing that drive test?
There was. I was contacted by law enforcement in June and was notified that they found the bodies of Ty Lee and JJ. And so immediately, I worked out the logistics to get the equipment I needed up to the Rexburg area. And I believe I was over there within about 6 days after the bodies were found to conduct that drive test.
Okay. And you mentioned going all the way from St. Anthony down to south of Rexburg. Why would you do such an expansive drive test for an area that goes so far beyond Mr. Daybell's property?
Sure. So the investigation at that point was still ongoing. And so in order to basically ensure that any use of cellular phones that became of interest for specific dates, we would be able to see what the true footprint of towers were versus doing those estimates. So basically just because of the case itself and what it was, there was continuing investigation. That's why I chose to do a larger area.
What is the equipment you use to perform a drive test? What is it called?
It's called a Gladiator Autonomous Receiver, or GAR for short.
And can anyone go to Walmart and pick up a GAR?
No. So when I talked about doing a drive test, the GAR is kind of it's a multiple component device. What that means is it not only includes the sensors, antennas associated with getting the readings of the cellular signal, it also includes a computer. It also includes the software that the FBI utilizes to get those raw measurements and get them all the way to a map so that we can utilize it as a part of an investigation.
Okay. So it has, just to make sure everyone understands, a physical and a software component.
Yes. The company provides a physical and a software component.
And you mentioned scanners in that equipment. Are the scanners within the GAR restricted to law enforcement?
No, they are not.
The GAR unit itself, is that restricted to law enforcement?
Yes. So the company that sells the GAR Gladiator, at least the last time I checked, they only sold to law enforcement.
Right. And you testified that you conducted this test in June of 2019?
In June of 2020.
June of 2020. I apologize. Thank you. Moving on, are you able to determine where a phone But by using cellular records, are you able to determine where a phone is located 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by identifying the tower and sector it uses?
No. So that's where I talked a little bit about before. We need a line on a call detail record at a specific date and time. And that's what allows me to give an estimate, is if I have a specific date and time where the phone interacted with a network and then the tower and sector that was used. So again, with the analogies, but if you think about it where you have a neighbor and you know what they drive. So if you look out the window at 9:01 in the morning and you see their car in the driveway, and then you go about your business and you go back 30 minutes later and the car is still in the driveway, you can't say what that car was doing for that time whenever you weren't looking out the window. The records are the same way. So whenever I have a record, I can make an estimate based on the tower and sector that was used. But if there's no use for a period of time, I can't make an estimate during that period of no use.
And again, does the cell phone always select the geographically closest tower?
No, it's going to select the strongest signal that it sees.
But so a phone, even if it doesn't select the closest tower, it will select a tower within the coverage area. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's correct. And that's why we conduct a drive test, is because a phone, in order to utilize a tower and sector, has to be able to see that tower and sector at the location where it is.
So regardless of the phone selecting the closest or slightly more distant tower, the phone's approximate area can still be estimated, correct?
Yes.
We've been talking about cell records. Are you familiar with Google location records?
I am.
Can you describe what they are?
So Google provides a service that includes location history. And so if a user opts into location history, then Google records locations where a device that is opted in has been located historically.
How does Google identify the location of a device?
A few different ways. One way is by the GPS within the phone, which is basically telling the lat long of where the phone is located at any given time. Also via Wi-Fi. And so what that means is the phone is utilizing the Wi-Fi in an area to determine an estimated location. And then also via cellular signal, which is where Google was giving an estimate based on the cellular towers that a phone sees.
Talking about the Wi-Fi connection through Google, does the device need to connect to a Wi-Fi access point for Google to know that location?
No. And if some of you have seen where you'll get a notification on your phone, turn on Wi-Fi to better estimate your accuracy, doesn't necessarily need to be connected to a Wi-Fi access point. Google, as a part of the information that they maintain, they have information on a lot of different Wi-Fi access points and where they're located. So as an example, if my phone, I'm nearby a Wi-Fi at a McDonald's, if Google knows where that Wi-Fi at the McDonald's is and knows that my phone sees that Wi-Fi, I don't need to be connected to it for Google to make an estimation that I'm close to where that McDonald's is.
Do the Google location records reflect information on the accuracy of their records?
Yes. So Google provides a margin of error associated with each line in their location record.
Have you used Google location information as part of investigations in the past?
I have. I've used it to locate devices on numerous occasions in the past.
Speaking to both cellular records and Google location records, are you able to pinpoint the exact location of a phone?
No. My estimate is based on the records that I'm reviewing, and depending on what those records are, that's going to affect how precise I can say on my estimate of a general location of a phone.
And are you able to pinpoint the exact location of a person with cellular records?
No. I'm looking primarily at devices that are reporting to different providers, not specifically a person. I think that's a common mistake. Whenever I'm evaluating records, I'm attempting to locate where the phone was. Now, granted, that could very well be in the pocket of the person it's associated with, but I'm not locating a person, I'm locating a device.
And do you regularly use cellular telephone technology and this Google location technology in your work?
Yes, on a daily basis.
Have you ever provided instruction in the field of historical cell site analysis?
I have. I've conducted numerous CAS basic courses throughout the United States, and then I've done presentations throughout the United States, in Mexico, and in the United Kingdom.
And have you ever provided expert testimony on this subject matter in the past?
I have.
Speaking about the records we've talked about, in addition to that, does CAST use any other type of records other than what we've been discussing?
So yes, CAST uses basically any of the records that we can obtain via a search warrant, and different providers provide different types of data sets that we can utilize. And primarily what that gives me is if there's a record that has a specific line that has a date and time, I can give an estimate where a phone was located.
Did you receive any records like that in this case?
Yes, but not none that were used as part of my reporting.
Agent, you did mention that you did examine records in this case.
Yes.
What records did you examine?
So numerous call detail records associated with multiple phones, as well as Google location history.
Are the records you relied upon to create this report voluminous?
They are.
And did you prepare a report that would summarize your findings that were relevant to this investigation?
I did.
Did you prepare this report in anticipation of testifying in this trial?
I did.
Do you believe that this report would aid the jury in understanding the various cell phone records you reviewed?
I do.
Was your report peer-reviewed by another member of CAST?
It was.
Your Honor, I'd ask that the witness be handed State's Exhibit 156, which is a thumb drive. Courtesy copy has been provided to court and counsel. Agent Balance, do you recognize State's Exhibit 156?
I do.
What is it?
It's a USB drive that I initialed that contained a copy of my report.
And have you reviewed the content of that thumb drive?
I have.
And is that a true and accurate representation of the report you prepared?
Yes, it is.
Your Honor, based on the witness's testimony and pursuant to Rule 1006 of the Idaho Rules of Evidence, we ask that this report be admitted into evidence as a summary exhibit.
Any objection, Mr. Pryor?
Judge, there won't be an objection, but I do need to have a sidebar with counsel in the court prior to proceeding.
Okay, let's go ahead and take up a sidebar. Yeah. Request of defense for a moment, Mr. Wood. All right, we had a brief sidebar just discussing evidence and discussing with both the state and the defense that there's additional information in terms of the data that led to this summary that is or will be admissible in the case. So when that matter comes up specifically, we'll take it up. And Mr. Wood, at this point, Exhibit 156 was offered. And based on that discussion on the sidebar, Mr. Pryor, is there any objection to 156 being admitted at this time?
Judge, as previously noted, there would be no objection to all of this data.
Okay, so the 156 is admitted, Mr. Wood.
Thank you. Your Honor, may I publish?
Yes.
And I'll be doing that through HDMI. Agent, do you recognize this exhibit?
I do.
If you could just briefly give us a summary of what's on this front page.
This is basically the cover page associated with my report, which includes the phone numbers that I did analysis on, as well as the Google account that I did analysis on, the specific dates that I was asked to look at, and then data report, case number, and my name.
And on slide two, what are you describing?
That's speaking specifically to the methodology used as a part of our analysis that I described previously.
And slide three?
The same thing, just specific to the Google location history.
So in preparing this report, just to be clear, you relied on cellular records like we talked about, meaning that the records of phones interacting with cell towers.
Is correct. That fair?
And then on Google location data.
Relied upon records we received from Google associated with the HomerJMaximus@gmail.com account.
And through your investigation, we'll get to that in a minute. Tell us about slide four.
So this is whenever I spoke to earlier about cellular towers and their locations kind of following what population looks like. So as you can see in Boise, the population is higher and you're going to see the towers are much more dense. And as you go out into the rural areas of Idaho, you see that those towers are farther apart and they're going to provide coverage to much larger footprint.
Tell us what we see on slide five.
This is just an example of what cellular towers can look like. So the traditional tower, kind of the second from the left, as well as providers' attempts to hide the towers to be more aesthetically pleasing via a cactus or a tree.
And what do we see on slide six?
So on the left, you'll see a traditional cell phone tower that's divided into the three different sectors that I talked about earlier. So you can see the sets of antennae are facing three different directions. Then over to the right, when I talked about that circle, this is looking over top of a cellular tower, and you can see the three different sectors divided into equal pieces. You can also see at the top where there's a zero. It's a little bit smaller, harder to see, but that zero starts there, and just like a compass, goes all the way around to 359 degrees. So whenever you're looking at a specific tower and sector, the provider will indicate the azimuth, which is basically the direction from the tower that that specific sector, the midpoint of it. So if you're looking at sector one, the azimuth of that sector would be 0 degrees, and you see plus 60 and minus 60 to equal 120.
There's a lot of information on this slide. What are we looking at?
This is just an example of what the call detail records that I spoke about earlier look like, specific to each carrier, starting with Verizon. And so what you'll see is the information I indicated, like the date, time, as well as on the right side, you'll see what starts with first serving cell site, first serving, it's kind of cut off, but that's showing the tower and sector that I would correspond with the tower list in order to place that on a map.
And page eight, what are we seeing there?
The same thing, just an example from AT&T, and you can see how the records and columns differ slightly, but still contain information as far as the date, time, originating number that starts the call, terminating number that ends the call, as well as the location information on the right side associated with the tower and sector that was used.
What are we seeing on page nine?
And then just to repeat, the same type of call detail record for T-Mobile.
Okay. Page 10, what is that?
So that's looking at how we would look at the Google location history. And so there you can see a date and timestamp, the estimated latitude and longitude, and then the confidence column, which is what I spoke to earlier, as far as the margin of error that Google estimates that specific line. And then a device tag, which is a way for Google to associate a specific device that was utilized on the account that was reporting that location information.
In that, I think you called it a confidence column, are there two different sources of information? And I get this is just an example, but if you can point out kind of those different sources of information and the numbers associated with those.
Yeah, so specific to this case, Google location history included locations that were derived from GPS, Wi-Fi, and cellular. That column there is where we can determine how that specific location was derived.
And the number next to it, what is that number?
To the left or to the right?
To the left.
To the left, that's the margin of error associated with that specific location in meters.
What are we seeing on slide 11?
So whenever you get into my report, those lines that are from a call detail record, I represent with basically a call information box so that that way you can see the specific location that's mapped, what that record indicated for date, time, direction of the call, type of call, and then the azimuth or direction from that tower that that interaction occurred, as well as any associated number for if it's a call or a text message.
What do we see on page 12?
These are the specific numbers that I was asked to conduct analysis on in this case. And then each one is going to be represented by a specific color whenever I place it on a map. So this is just basically a legend so that you can see whenever you observe a specific use on a map, which phone that I'm representing.
And what are we seeing on page 13?
This is an example of the drive test data that I spoke about. So after we conduct that drive test and then place that information onto a map, this is how it would look. So on the left side, you see one tower and sector and the coverage area of that tower and sector. The dark green is the dominant area of coverage. And then the lighter green is just the coverage area. So what that means is if the phone is within that darker green, it would likely select that tower and sector in order to have an interaction. But it could also be anywhere in that lighter green and still see that specific tower and sector. Then on the right, you're seeing two different towers and sectors, one at the top right, represented in red, and then the tower and sector at the bottom right, coverage area represented in yellow. And then you can see the orange area is where there's overlapping coverage between those two towers and sectors.
And what do we see on page 14?
This follows the same call box as the cellular slide, only it indicates what the box will look like for Google location information. I've also got at the bottom right, because with Google location, there could be numerous locations recorded in a matter of minutes. So instead of, in essence, putting a lot of stuff onto a map that doesn't allow you to see what's going on, I've added a summary location or a Google geolocation summary box so you can see how many locations were recorded in a specific amount of time. You can also see on the left side the Wi-Fi or GPS. That's the icon that'll be represented whenever a Google location is derived from one of those two events. And then also where applicable, the margin of error will be that yellow circle, which will show a representation of what that margin of error looked like from the record.
What do we see on page 15?
Locations of significance with this investigation.
And if you would just go down and read those items.
Sure. So the burn pit location, which is on Mr. Daybell's property, Tylee Ryan body location, which was on Mr. Daybell's property, and same thing for JJ Vallow. Chad Daybell's residence, Lori Vallow's residence, Alex Cox's residence, the location of the Salem Church, location of a Holiday Inn Express in Springville, Utah, Evergreen Cemetery in Springville, Utah, a Walmart located in Rexburg, Wireless Revolution, which is also located in Rexburg, a store that is associated with cell phones and AT&T, Brigham Young University Library in Rexburg, Sportsman's Warehouse down in Idaho Falls, and then a Marriott Residence Inn in Kansas City, Missouri.
Can you explain to the jury what we see on page 17 of your report?
Sure. So this is an overview of Rexburg and the surrounding area. I didn't mention before, but you can see the dots. Those are representative of cell phone towers for the different networks that provide coverage in the area, as well as the locations placed onto a map that I mentioned in the last slide that were of significance to this investigation.
If you have a pointer, and I realize that on the screen it's a little bit further away, but if you could just kind of go through a couple of those locations on the map.
Yes. So the green marked CD is for Chad Daybell's property. And I know I mentioned other locations on that property, but whenever you zoom out, there's no way that I could add all of those and they would be representative of the specific location. Below that is the Salem Church, Walmart in Rexburg, Wireless Revolution, L for the library on the university grounds, and then LV for Lori Vallow's apartment.
And on page 18, what do we see?
Those were the locations of significance mentioned down in Springville, Utah. So the EG is the Evergreen Cemetery and the HI is the Holiday Inn Express.
So, Agent, were you asked to look at a couple of or some specific dates as part of your investigation?
I was.
We just saw a slide that said September 9th. Was your involvement in this investigation concurrent with other investigators working on this case?
It was.
And what was significant about the date September 9th to you?
So based on conversations that I'd had with investigators, they had determined that September 8th was likely the last time that Tylee Ryan was photographed alive.
Okay, thank you. So slide 20, if you can walk the jury through what we're seeing here and where it's at.
Yeah, so I'll be a little bit more specific in this one because the majority of my slides are going to follow this same format. So at the top, you're seeing what it is. This is based on Google location history, the account that is associated with that Google location, and all the Google location history in this report is going to be for homerjmaximus@gmail.com. And then you're seeing basically the bookends of what this slide represents. And by that, I mean we're looking at September 9th. For any locations between 12 a.m. and 5 o'clock a.m. Also, with all of my analysis of the Google location history, I looked at Google locations that were 100 meters or less in margin of error. So then we see...
Agent, if I can stop you there, why did you pick 100 meters or less?
just to ensure that whenever you look at Google location, you can see margin of errors that can be extremely wide in the thousands of meters. So we did that to basically look at the more precise locations from the reporting.
So is it fair to say you did that in an effort to be more accurate?
The locations that are larger margin of error are accurate, but it helps us to basically look at a specific device and where it's located. When you start getting extremely large margins of error, I wouldn't be able to differentiate whether a device was, in this slide, at reporting from Alex Cox's residence or Lori Vallow's residence. So 100 meters was basically just the line that I set as far as what precision we were looking at.
And when we speak about the Homer J. Maximus at Gmail account, that has been brought up before, but can you remind the jury who that account is associated with?
With Alex Cox.
All right. So you've taken us through the heading. Can you walk us through the rest of the slide?
Yeah, so you'll see two different locations that both are reported via GPS. And so on the top left, if you can see the pointer, we're looking at 242 in 2 seconds, 242 in 11 seconds, and 337 in 22 seconds. Google location consistent with being just west of Lori Vallow's apartment. And then there's movement between 337 and 437, where at 437, it's now reporting pointer consistent with being at Alex Cox's apartment.
And so just to verify the time here, we're talking about 2:42 a.m. September 9th.
Correct.
And just to make sure we're interpreting the data correctly, what this shows is that Alex Cox's...
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. There seems to be some leading.
Sustained.
Your Honor, may I briefly argue?
Just ask another non-leading question, please, Mr. Wood.
Thank you. So the yellow dots are associated with locations of, what are those associated with?
So those are associated with a Google location of Alex Cox's device.
And if just to briefly summarize, on what times are Alex Cox's device located near Lori Vallow's residence?
At 2:42 in the morning and then at 3:37 in the morning.
And then after that, where does his device appear to go?
So there are no records that I found of 100 meters or less between 337 and 437. At 437, the Google location is consistent with being at Alex Cox's residence.
Agent, what do we see on slide 21?
So again, I'll go through this a little bit more in detail just because it's the first time you're seeing a tower and sector being mapped. So at the top, it's tower interactions, cellular tower interactions. And then below that, I'm going to indicate which phone numbers are associated with what I mapped. And then again, with the bookend of what times I was looking at. So this specifically is looking at September 9th from 7:20 in the morning until 8:04 in the morning. The tower at the top is associated with the 0143 phone, which was associated with Chad Daybell. That's utilizing a tower and sector that provides coverage to the Chad Daybell residence. And then there are multiple text messages and then a call at 8:03. And then, as I mentioned before, Verizon does not record the location information for text messaging. So because of that, we can see that the text messages are being exchanged with the Lori Vallow 4652 phone, but we don't see the tower and sector that her phone utilized in those text messages. We do, however, see on the phone call that occurs at 8:03 from the Daybell 4652 phone from the Daybell 0143 phone to the Lori Vallow 4652 phone. We see that the Lori Vallow phone is utilizing a tower and sector that provides coverage to her residence.
And you know, what was the date and time frame for these conversations?
Yeah, so the text messages were 7:20 in the morning, 7:42, 7:53, 8 o'clock, and then 8:03. And then the phone call is from the Daybell 0143 to the Vallow 4652 phone at 8:03.
Agent, in your review of phone records, how often would Lori Daybell and Chad, Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell communicate with each other?
Pretty regularly.
So slide 22, wow, what are we seeing there?
Okay, so this is a different phone associated with Chad Daybell, ending 9374. This is on the Verizon network, and it's utilizing a tower and sector that provides coverage to the Daybell residents to make an outbound call to a phone associated with Alex Cox, ending in 9120. Alex Cox's phone at that time was utilizing a tower and sector that provides coverage to his residents.
That was September 9th at 8:11 a.m.
Correct.
Can you tell how long of a phone call that was?
Yes. So in the box, you'll see after the outgoing call, you'll see 180, then you'll see voice, and then you'll see 280. That 180 represents the duration of the call, and then the 280 represents the azimuth or direction from the tower that that antenna set was facing.
So it was a 180-second call.
Correct.
And what do we see on slide 23?
So this is the Daybell 0143 phone utilizing three different towers, all of which provide coverage to his residents between 8:15 in the morning and 9:06 in the morning.
And who are those communications with? Can you tell?
Yeah, so one at 8:58 is an outbound text to the Lori Vallow 4652 phone. And then at 8:15 and 8:39, there's an outbound and an inbound text, both associated with an exchange with Lori Vallow's 4652 phone. And then the other incoming SMS at 9:05 is a number that I don't recognize.
Agent, what are we seeing on slide 24?
This is showing from the previous slide the three towers that were utilized and the true coverage area obtained via the drive test. And so what you can see is there's coverage represented by red on the top right. The next one over to the left is in green, and the bottom left is in yellow. But the orange color represents a overlapping coverage area. So usually that's significant as a part of my analysis, because if a phone utilizes multiple towers in close proximity and time, I can estimate that that phone needs to be or has to be within that overlapping coverage area, depending on how far apart in time they were, or at least close to that overlapping coverage area.
So if we go back a slide and where I'm pointing the mouse, are those different towers that are being utilized by Chad Daybell's phone?
Yes. So if you're looking starting on the right at 8:39 in the morning, it utilizes the tower in St. Anthony, 8:58, the tower in Parker, and then 9:05, the tower to the far southwest. So within that 26-minute window, you're looking at the phone would need to be near those overlapping coverage areas. Otherwise, you would have to, in essence, be in one coverage area and move to another one in order to get service from that particular tower and sector.
And so again, slide 24 is a map of that coverage area.
Correct.
And what is slide 25?
That's just zoomed in, showing that all three of those towers provide coverage to the Daybell residents.
Agent, what do we see in slide 26?
So here we're seeing Google location history associated with one of Alex Cox's devices, indicating that at 8:49 in the morning, it's consistent with being down in the area of his apartment. And by 9:15, it's consistent with being just south of Chad Daybell's property.
And can you point those locations out to the jury?
For sure.
And the times associated with those locations.
So that's the Google location at 8:49 and 19 on the bottom left of the screen. And then at the top is at 9:15.
And what are I should have asked earlier, what are the margins of error associated with those hits?
8 meters at the bottom and then 3 meters at the top, both reporting via GPS.
And so the measurement at 9:15 is just south of Mr. Daybell's residence.
That's correct.
Agent, what do we see on page 27?
So here you're seeing Google location history associated with a device reporting from Alex Cox's Gmail account. And you're seeing multiple different locations that were mapped during that time window. So the first one that we see is at 9:21 and 36 seconds.
And Agent, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if you can use the pointer.
Yeah, for sure.
And show the jury which box box and you're pointing to as you go through these.
Yep. So at 9:21 and 36 seconds, we see a Google location history reported or data line that shows a margin of error of 6 meters, very close in proximity to the area where Ty Lee was found. And then we see at 9:22 and 50 seconds, a location over here that is a 3 meter margin of error. And then we see two additional at 10:39 and 10:57. The 10:39 has a 43 meter margin of error, which is that larger yellow circle. And then 10:57, we have a 5 meter margin of error, again, in the area where Ty Lee's body was found.
Agent, did you personally go to this property?
I did.
Was there anything significant to you on the northwest corner where there is the hit at 9:22? Anything significant to you in that area?
There was. There's a gate that allows you to access the property via vehicle right there. That's actually how we entered the property with the drive test equipment.
And can you remind the jury what BP stands for?
The burn pit.
And the TY, is that the location of Ty Lee's body?
Yes.
And again, this was September 9th?
Correct.
Take a quick break here, Mr. Wood.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll go ahead and just take our morning recess here and take about 20, 25 minutes on the recess, and then we'll come back on.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.